This is Friday, September 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, we take you to Charlotte, North Carolina, the scene of protest over the shooting of a black man by police. We'll take an in-depth look at what's happening as instances of violence seem to increase.
When you look at the rate of racial injustice by police killings and things like that, the overall rate hasn't changed much over the past decade. What has changed is technology.
Also ahead, what is really Russia's role in Syria and a preview of the first U.S. presidential debate. All on today's International Edition. Large crowds of demonstrators marched through the heart of the eastern U.S. state of North Carolina's largest city Thursday in the third night of protest against the Charlotte Police Department's handling of a controversial police shooting of a black man. Police in riot gear were dispersed throughout the city. The officers were armed with rubber bullets and tear gas, but they didn't use them as protests remained relatively calm. Let's go to Charlotte now, where VOA's Isha Sarai has been following the situation. Isha, things remain peaceful in the city?
Yes, they have, Ira. Last night, you know, was relatively calm. There were still, at its peak, about 1,000 protesters throughout the streets, and they were out well after the midnight curfew that was imposed by Governor Pat McCrory. But everything stayed calm, and we spoke with Charlotte's one of their police generals, who said that as long as protests remain peaceful, they had no intention of imposing the curfew.
Although they're not lifting it, right?
No, they're not lifting it. The mayor announced at a press conference this morning that as long as the state of emergency remains in Charlotte, which it remains today, there will still technically be a midnight curfew.
Then there is the whole issue of the video that police have, and there are calls for making it public. We understand that the family of the victim has already seen it, have different reactions to what they saw and what police saw. What's the latest on that?
Yes, so this morning the mayor of Charlotte announced that she had seen it and said that from what she saw, the visual quality made all evidence inconclusive. The family seems to have released a similar statement. From what I understand, I think that why the city of Charlotte is so outraged at this video not being released is because the past few police shootings of African Americans that have happened in the U.S., someone has had a video, whether it be on a cell phone or whether the police department released the footage early. And I think that since we've become used to this technology, the public and various organizations throughout the country are saying that this is, it's not making for a transparent investigation.
You've been around the city, looking around, as a reporter always does. What's the feeling of the city? There was a lot of anger the other day. What's the feeling of it that you get?
I really have to stress how drastically different the feeling is during the day versus at night. Even yesterday and this morning when we were attending press conferences, the people that are there aren't the same people you see on the streets at night. You know, today a lot of businesses are closed, but the streets aren't deserted. People seem peaceful. They seem relatively positive. They're going about their day. But at night, the temperature changes a little bit. And again, I'd like to stress that, last night there were about 1,000 people, but it was very peaceful. It was very calm. And I know that's a big change from the past few days.
But the state of emergency does remain, and there will again be National Guard troops on the streets tonight?
Yes, and there were plenty of them last night, and they're expected to be there again tonight. I think, the violence Wednesday night was just really so overwhelming. A lot of tear gas, a lot of rubber bullets, and the first civilian was pronounced dead yesterday morning after having been shot in protest Wednesday night, and I think that authorities are just trying to be careful and want to keep the state of emergency until they're positive that everything is calmed down.
VOA's Isha Sarai in Charlotte, North Carolina. Isha, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Ira.
All right, and we are hopefully trying to get an interview dealing with what is happening as far as race relations are concerned. We don't have it? Okay. Well, let's work on it, okay, shall we?
Jazz America!
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America,
where each week we give you the best of jazz, past and present, and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Why has the protest movement surrounding police shootings of minorities and similar situations climbed to the top of the list of important news stories over the past year? Well, Christopher Bracey is an internationally recognized expert in the fields of U.S. race relations, individual rights. Professor Bracey teaches and researches at George Washington University Law School here in Washington. Professor, have race relations deteriorated in the United States, or is it something new?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you raise that, because a lot of this is perception, and in some ways perception starts to become reality. When you look at the rate of racial injustice by police killings and things like that, the overall rate hasn't changed much over the past decade. What has changed is technology, and that has provided for greater awareness of racial injustice. And I think what you see is a reaction to the sort of reality of racial injustice from people who were previously insulated from those experiences.
So are things better now or worse now than they have been in the past?
I think the perception is that things are much worse. The reality is that this cycle of incident, outrage, and inaction has been a part of the African-American experience for the better part of a century. And so in that sense, there's nothing new. I think what is new, again, is the awareness of this injustice, this cycle of injustice, and that there's a certain fatigue that comes in from the repetition.
And I guess one of the things to which you refer is social media and the way that is spread around so quickly. Do you think that has helped the situation or hurt it?
Well, I mean, I think that it's actually helped the situation insofar as that there's a greater level of awareness, and that these are no longer mythical tales that have been spun out of the black community, but they are now documented and chronicled and able to be distributed to a much wider audience. And what that means is that there's a greater chance for bringing people together around these issues as opposed to using them as wedge issues or divisive issues during political seasons.
How do you see the evidence and the incidents of violence that are taking place in some of these protests?
Well, the violence that is occasioned by the protests is unfortunate. And the reality, of course, is that that is a reflection of frustration with the lack of process and a sense of injustice that is caused. Whenever you have the killing of a black body in the streets and there isn't any legal recourse or there isn't any meaningful response by the criminal justice system and people are not being held accountable, it's the same sort of frustration and violence that one saw during the civil rights era when there was a perception that the system itself was broken.
So is this a time that some progress can be made, and do you see any progress being made?
I think this is a time for progress to be made. The best part of the story, and I mean the overwhelming narrative here is negative, but the best part of this story is that there is an increased awareness that the system is in fact broken, and there are people who are trying to do the right thing. There are police officers, line officers that are standing with the protesters and saying, in effect, that this is not how we envision our role as law enforcement officials. We're here to protect and serve, not to destroy. And so it was good last night, for instance, in Charlotte to see the police along with the protesters de-escalating the tension, looking for common ground and a common solution.
How else do you see finding a way to do something about this situation? How do we make it better?
Well, I think it begins by acknowledging that there is a problem. And if you look at the prevailing discourse within American race relations right now, there still is a contest of ideas. There are cohorts of people who are willing to admit that there is a problem, that the system of criminal justice is broken, that there is a problem, a cultural problem within the law enforcement community. The Department of Justice in Baltimore has issued a report about the Baltimore police community saying, in effect, that it is a culture in crisis and needs to be corrected. And yet there are folks on the other side of the dialogue who insist that there really isn't much wrong with the state of policing and criminal justice, and that the Black Lives Matter movement and folks who are advocating for greater accountability are simply exaggerating and making a big to-do over nothing.
So there are still questions being asked, and I thank you for answering some of mine today. Professor Christopher Bracey teaches and researches in the areas of legal history of U.S. race relations, constitutional law, criminal procedure, civil procedure, and civil rights at George Washington University Law School. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, let's head up to New York City, where International Edition's social media guru, Andrew Palczewski, joins us. You heard what he said about social media. It is important in this thing. And what's trending as far as Charlotte and Tulsa and those stories are concerned today, Andrew?
Well, this is so apropos of that interview, because what we see time and time again when these protests go on is that there's this overarching arc of the protests, but then these key moments that kind of pop up. And the key moment that's trending today is Congressman Robert Pittenger of North Carolina. Now, the reason why he's trending is because he said in an interview that the protesters hate white people because white people are successful and they're not. Now, obviously, these comments are not sitting well with people on the internet. They're already calling for his resignation from Congress. And that phrase, hate white people, is trending as people are just reacting with disbelief that he's said this and kind of added fuel to the fire of these race relations and these race tensions. And it set off this debate and kind of added fire to the debate as well, at times getting very ugly on social media as people fight back and forth over these comments. So this is one of those developing stories, one of these flashpoints in the overarching protest, and we'll see how this ends up for Congressman Pittenger.
And again, we are seeing how important social media, or what big of a part social media plays as far as this ongoing story of race in America is concerned.
Absolutely. Just the video, the ability to bring people into the protest. They may be hundreds or even thousands of miles away, but they're experiencing it firsthand. They're seeing it from the perspective of the protesters through things like Facebook Live, through Twitter video. So it really is an immersive experience through the social media. It's connecting a lot more people to it. And I think that's causing people to feel like they have a better connection to this story. They're not just reading about it. They're seeing it through that perspective with their own eyes.
Andrew Palczewski, our social media guru, joining us from New York. Follow Andrew on Twitter at @apal. And how else?
And we can find you at VOA Melman.
I rely on you in that.
This is a good back and forth we have. I like it. Even from hundreds of miles away, we still keep it up.
I don't
it's
know
great.
Where I stand. All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. We'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good. Thank you.
This is VOA. Among the top stories we are following, overnight violence decreases in Charlotte, North Carolina, in the wake of the shooting death of a man by police. Residents of Syria's rebel-held city Aleppo have reported a surge of airstrikes. Officials at Yahoo.com say computer hackers may have stolen information from at least 500 million user accounts. And the bodies of 162 people have been pulled from the waters off the Egyptian coast 2 days after a boat carrying hundreds of migrants capsized in the Mediterranean while attempting to head to Europe. Expanded coverage of these and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. We mentioned the Syria story. Residents of Syria's rebel-held city of Aleppo have reported a surge in airstrikes, with local monitors saying to have killed at least 30 people did the bombing. Syrian government announced a renewed offensive in the city after U.S. and Russia failed to salvage a ceasefire that had diffused hostilities for nearly a week. Witnesses say the intensified bombing campaign in Aleppo, reportedly carried out by Syrian helicopters and Russian warplanes, started late Wednesday and has continued since, targeting residential areas and buildings used by a volunteer group known as the White Helmets. U.S. military and intelligence officials are questioning whether Russia has the will or the capability to do anything about the growing crisis in Syria, accusing Moscow of perpetuating a humanitarian catastrophe. VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Seldon has been following this. What do we know about Russian intentions in Syria?
Well, it's very complicated for starters. The U.S. intelligence community believes that Russia got into Syria for several reasons. One, Russia does have some military bases there. It had a naval presence in Syria, and with the country beginning to fall apart, the regime losing control, Russia desperately wanted to protect what really is its last toehold in the Middle East. So that's one thing that Russia wanted to do. It sent in planes, it sent in helicopters, artillery, missile defense systems, and anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 troops to man all those systems. And so it's been protecting its assets. It's also been helping the Syrian regime in areas where it's been weak, including in areas around Aleppo. There's also a very strong suspicion that Russia's been using the Syrian conflict especially to show off some of its newer military hardware. Over the last several years, Russian defense spending has soared. They've put a lot into modernizing their forces, and they're trying, and there's a line of thought that they're trying to generate more sales for their military equipment so they can make more money. And there's also a strong sense from high top officials in the intelligence community that Russian President Vladimir Putin saw Syria as another opportunity to regain Russian prestige. There's a thought that he really wants to recreate the world in which he grew up, the world of the Cold War, where it was the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and without the Soviets or the Russians, nothing really could get done. And intelligence officials said this past week in a public forum that is, in essentially, he was able to do that with Syria. He was able to have the U.S. bring Russia to the table as an equal. Now it gets a little trickier, though, because how do you extricate from Syria? Is there an exit strategy? Some tend to think that Russia is going to back Assad until the end. Others wonder, though, whether or not perhaps Russia is losing a bit of control over the situation, that one official called Assad delusional after hearing about the new attacks on Aleppo and said basically it seems that Russia doesn't want to or doesn't have the ability to tell its proxy stop.
Some parts of the U.S. government, especially the Department of Defense, in hearings yesterday on Capitol Hill, are taking a very hard line. America's top general, Joseph Dunford, questioned whether the U.S. should share intelligence with Russia. We're taking a hard line. How and why?
Well, one of the things that Russia was trying to do with the ceasefire negotiations on Syria is, again, to raise its prestige. One of the plans, had the ceasefire held, was for the U.S. and Russia to establish what they were calling a joint integration center, which basically would be there to share information so that both sides can continue to hit the terrorists. Jabhat al-Nusra, or Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, as they're calling themselves now, Islamic State, which were still legitimate targets, even with the ceasefire. And The U.S. military was reportedly kicking and screaming, not wanting to do that. And now top officials are saying, you see what happened to the aid convoy in Aleppo? There's no way the U.S. wants to or should be sharing sensitive intelligence with Russia.
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. As always, Jeff, thank you.
Anytime.
This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. We head to New York City now, where our finance reporter, market reporter, Jill Malandrino. What do I call you, Jill?
We do it all here.
Okay, that is correct. Standing by with a look at Wall Street. What's going on?
All right, well, the next catalyst for markets, now that we're done with the Fed, is the first presidential debate on Monday, which is expected to capture 120 million viewers. How does that impact the market? Given recent headlines, for example, both financial services and healthcare sectors will likely be areas of critical focus. Also, both candidates will likely highlight the need for more cybersecurity and help boost investor sentiment for that group. And, of course, the macro issues on trade and taxation.
Jill, once again, I appreciate it. For the brevity, we have one of these days we'll get you on for a long time, and let's talk about whatever's going on, okay?
All right, looking forward to it.
Jill Malandrino with us. The next phase of the presidential election here in the United States begins Monday in Hempstead, New York. That's on Long Island, when Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican Donald Trump face off in the first of three presidential debates. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone is here with a preview. Jim, how will this debate, in your opinion, differ from all other presidential debates?
Well, the other debates were playoff contender debates. This is the Super Bowl. And it's the first of three for the two presidential contenders. There'll be one between the two vice presidential contenders. History tells us, Ira, that the first debate is the most watched. And so in that sense, it can kind of set a tone for what's to come. 4 years ago, Barack Obama had a pretty weak first debate. Mitt Romney started to creep up in the polls. Obama was later able to right the ship, so to speak, in subsequent debates. Obviously, in this one, a great deal of focus on which version of Donald Trump will show up and which version of Hillary Clinton, because they both demonstrated various personalities during the campaign.
We really don't know either. I mean, what do you see as the strategy of either or both candidates?
If you find out, you should probably tell the Clinton campaign, because I think they're preparing for any number of different versions of Donald Trump to show up. Listen, of late, Trump's been more disciplined, been more kind of, focused and not distracted by these controversial attacks and things. So in that sense, he may have an opportunity to expand his base if he continues that in the debate. Clinton, it's always a question of how she comes across to voters. Will she be able to engage with them on a more personal level? That'll be one of her challenges.
Yeah, and we are all looking forward to this. You can hear it right here on VOA, radio, TV, online, everything, all of our 34,000 platforms, correct?
Exactly.
And you'll be working all of them on Monday night.
I will be part of that and look forward to it.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for joining us. Our director, Patrice Martin, engineer, Pete Hanley. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Enjoy your day. Enjoy your weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's no secret that the best way to jumpstart a sluggish economy is to invest in women. That's because when women enter the formal economy, they invest their earnings into their families and their communities, pulling both out of poverty. It's also true that the more formal education a woman attains, the more money she earns, thus contributing even more to those around her. For many years now, the United States has been working to advance the rights of women and girls around the world and to help open wide some of the doors that have kept women from rising within their societies, from advancing to high political office, and from attaining the highest levels of education that lead to better jobs. When it comes to education and employment, women are most severely underrepresented in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. This is true nearly everywhere, but particularly in those regions where women who pursue careers in these fields lack support. And through long experience, we have found that mentoring such women helps improve their chances of success. That is why, 6 years ago, the United States initiated the Tech Women Program, which helps women in these fields living in the Middle East, Africa, and Central Asia to reach their full potential. Tech Women helps them strengthen their entrepreneurial and product development skills, build networks of people in their chosen field, and learn meaningful ways to be an effective resource for young women and girls, and to play an active role in the economic advancement of their home country. In September, the latest group of nearly 90 women from 19 countries arrived in the United States to take part in this year's Tech Women program. These women, already leaders in the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics fields, are collaborating with their American counterparts on specific projects at leading science and technology companies in the San Francisco Bay Area and Silicon Valley. Once this year's program ends on October 17th, the women will return home to expand the Tech Women Network, collaborate with women who participated in previous year's Tech Women programs, and to conduct workshops for women and girls who have expressed interest in pursuing science and technology-based careers. They will help develop the next class of Tech Women and create greater opportunities for generations of girls to come.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.